Hello, good morning and good afternoon and good evening, and welcome to the Brew and Bite Show. My name is Craig and this is episode 10, MacBooks and Dinosaurs. This week I'm very pleased to say that we are joined by not one but two very special guests, and today we're going to dive into all of this week's Apple's news, from the return of the MagSafe to what's up with WhatsApp. But let's first say hello to our panel. Let's say hello to Martin first. How are
you? Good evening, Craig. Yeah, I'm good. Feeling fit, feeling fine. Bit of snow out there. So, yeah, it's a good day so far. And United won 3-2 over Liverpool. So, yes!
That's not the only snowball he played with, I bet. And next up, we have Alistair. How are you this week?
I'm good, thanks, Craig. And enjoying fixing computers whilst it's all snowing outside and taking photos.
That's good. And next up we have Tina. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I had a lovely snowy walk this morning. So, you know, got to see the local area. All very pretty. Oh,
I had slush when I went out to the supermarket. That's all I saw today.
Well, you weren't early enough. I was out at about 9:30, so I was walking about all in the snow in Wanstead Park, which was amazing.
There's nothing being the first person to walk across an area. Feet prints down first, isn't there? Great.
Oh, we know who makes the snow angels then. That's Martin for sure.
That's me, yep.
And next up, I'm really pleased to say we have two very special guests, and we are definitely extremely socially distanced by a few thousand miles rather than 2 metres. First up, let's say hello to former columnist and Mac expert Nancy. How are you?
I'm just fine, and I'm just so jealous that y'all have snow and we have rain, but I'm happy for you that you get to experience it.
Last but not least, we have our wonderful Mac expert, author and podcaster, and I shall let him do his introduction. Let's say hello to Jeff.
Now, I liked your introduction. That was great. And it's awesome to get to be here. Thank you very much. And what a wonderful surprise to find out that I get to be on a show, not just with all of you, but also with Nancy Gravely. Oh my God, that's wonderful. And since everyone has talked about snow, I feel like I'm obligated. I suppose by the rest of the world standards, it snowed here, but in Colorado, there's like a threshold where it doesn't count. So there was white on everything this morning when I looked outside. And yet if someone were to ask me, did it snow last night? I would say no, because it's not enough to count as snow.
Jeff, can I ask for our British viewers, you say you and Nancy have known each other. Where does that go back to? Where do you and Nancy first go back to in your Apple Mac history?
Nancy and I, we go way back. We go so far back that when we would go to the Mac Observer offices, we would ride our dinosaurs to get there. So Nancy and I both worked for the Mac Observer, and I have to say it was just an absolute dream getting to work with Nancy.
I'm going to ask a random question. If you can remember far back to your dinosaur years, what was the first product that you came across when you joined the Mac Observer?
It was the very first thing that I wrote about. And this is awful because I actually can't remember the product. It was something Apple related. And I wrote the article, and within minutes of it going live, there was already hate comments attached to it. You know, people saying you're an Apple shill and you should be fired. And I was thinking, seriously, is this what I signed up for here?
So 20 odd years later, has nothing changed then, Jeff?
No, nothing has changed. Apparently, I am still a secret agent for Apple, and they tell me all the things before they tell anyone else. And I have a direct line to Tim Cook, and everything that's wrong with the product is because I called him and told him to make it that way. Yeah, you know.
What about you, Nancy? It's the first memories you can have of your Apple Mac experience?
My first Mac experience occurred before I went to work for TMO, I had just finished graduate school, went through graduate school without a computer, and my adorable son did some web design work for a doctor, and my son took a computer as payment, and he gave that to me, and it was the kind that were in the little box, you know, the little tiny one, and I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven. And when I was approached to write for the Mac Observer, I was like, I'm not, why me? But they wanted somebody who could write for older people learning to use Macs for the first time. People who didn't grow up with them. People like me who learned to type on a manual typewriter. And my column was called Computing with Bifocals, to let those people know that they had a resource. And there are a lot of resources out there now, but back then, people just, there wasn't anything people were afraid, older people were afraid of the computers. They were afraid they were going to break them.
Well, that's amazing. That's almost come full circle for you, Nancy, then, with people, older people now getting into Zoom and all these new fangled means of communication. That's strange. Are you asked similar sort of questions now about that by our more mature group of people that we have?
Well, I do it now through our Mac users group, CapMac in Austin, but with training. And yes, a lot of the first-time users who are older are just as they're confused by the same kinds of things. The only difference is that there's a little bit more resources out there for them now than there was back when I started. And I loved writing that column. I would get hate mail too, Jeff. My hate mail came from sons who would say, "How dare you introduce my mother to a Mac?" literally. It was like, "How dare you?" And it's like, I taught her to use a PC, and she's been doing all my office work, and now she wants this Mac, and I don't know what software, and blah, 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 blah. And I love those letters. I just love them.
You should just, I hope you have those framed on your wall.
No, I use them for columns. I mean, they were great fodder for columns.
That's awesome. I just realized, did I even answer the question you asked me?
Sort of. You couldn't remember the, but you could remember the experience. And that sounds like that was quite an exciting, I love the idea of hate mail, you know, over something like a review. It's just amazing.
It proves that Apple fanboy has not gone away. Okay, shall we jump on to our first news topic this week? Of course, it's from the rumor mill. I don't know if any of you have seen, but there are rumors that Apple are supposedly working on or soon to introduce the Podcast Plus system. So rumor has it is that Apple are supposedly working with third-party podcast creators and other famous YouTubers alike on producing a advanced or subscription-based service into podcasts, similar to what they have done with their news. I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that.
I'm a bit late to the game, considering that podcasts have been out for considerable amount of time. Was it 2004, 2005, and they're only just thinking it might be a good idea to produce a library for them? Would anyone be bothered to listen to Apple over other podcasts that they used to?
Saying Apple's late to the game is totally spot on, and totally Apple's modus operandi. They always wait and let everyone else mess around with it, and whatever it is, and then they figure out what they want to do with that thing and then do it. And so Apple not having a subscription podcast service yet is no surprise, and it seems like, of course, it's coming, because it's just part of the natural progression of the podcast product market. And it's another thing that will just dovetail nicely in with all the other original content that they're creating. And yep, they're late to the game, but they're always late to the game. And ultimately, it doesn't matter because whatever they do, it's going to be something that people are interested in.
I think that's going to be the key, isn't it? It's what value they add to it. And sometimes, is it Steve Jobs says, you don't give people necessarily what they want. You give them things that they didn't know that they wanted or needed. And I don't know. It will be interesting to see what they add to the process, because actually, are they going to make it easier to discover things? Are they going to do curation? Are they going to do things where if they think you like this sort of thing, make suggestions? So it will be interesting.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what they come out with.
Do you think that they're also looking at what their competitors are doing? Because I know that Spotify have made some investments into other companies and bought them and integrated their services. You've also got Amazon in terms of their Audible book series. They're now launching a podcast system, which is subscription-based.
Yeah, of course they're watching what everyone else is doing. It's what Apple does. And I'm assuming that in addition to looking at what we're seeing from the consumer side, they're looking at what's happening on the service side as well, and figuring out what Spotify is doing right and wrong, what Amazon's getting right or wrong, what all the services are getting right and wrong. And then they're going to cherry pick from all of that to come up with what they think is a better system, or at least a better library of content.
And they'll charge slightly more than anyone else for it.
I think it's going to be another thing that rolls into their whole bulk subscription thing. I just forgot the name of it. Apple Plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you'll be able to subscribe to it. And actually, we make the joke about how Apple is going to charge more for it. But if we look at what they're charging for their other entertainment or content subscriptions, it's all competitive. So at least from a price point. So I'm betting they're going to keep this at a competitive price point as well. And then we'll have the thing where some people look at it and say, look, the price point, they're actually beating other people or other companies. And then we'll have the other side of it where people will say, yeah, but they don't have as much content as everyone else, so it makes it feel like it costs more.
But they've always had a history of almost like being a cuckoo into any industry. They'll come in and they'll upset the apple cart. I think the initial cost may be slightly higher, but it's like now the Apple One, the content of that, when I went for and subscribed to that, I was actually paying less per month than all the little bits and pieces I had been paying. And the fact that I can now share it over my family, everyone's using it, it just made it a no-brainer for cost-wise. To me, it's fantastic value, which is not something you normally associate with Apple, is it, when you say that?
Yeah, I agree. And thank you for saying Apple One, because that was the product name that for some reason just was gone from my head. Yeah, Apple One, I think, is a really well-priced bundle package. That's redundant.
Bundle. Well, who's Podcast Plus going to be aimed at, though?
I have a question, if I may. Is this podcast product that you're talking about for people to create their own podcasts like this one, or are they just for making podcasts available?
That would be an interesting question, because Apple's podcast doesn't use chapter marks currently. So if you're playing a podcast that has these marks, the podcast application currently ignores it and just plays the entire podcast as one track. So if you would like to skip an advert or go back to a certain part of a podcast using the backwards or forwards keys, you currently can't do this. Wouldn't it be nice if Apple could have an application which says record using FaceTime to make life easier?
That would be great. I don't expect it, because they already gave us the slap in the face with GarageBand, where they gave us podcast recording and publishing tools and then took them away. No, I'm not bitter about that. And Nancy, my take on Apple's podcast subscription, rumored podcast subscription service, is that it's going to be like what we're seeing from Spotify and Amazon Prime, where they have what we'll call premium content podcasts, and you subscribe to be able to listen or watch.
The next topic, of course, has to be, will we ever see one, an Apple car? So rumor has it this week that Hyundai is supposedly working with Apple. They made a comment and now they've decided to retract their comment in that they was in discussions with Apple in regards to an electric car. I don't know if any of you saw that or would ever buy one.
The car would probably be manufactured by the US arm of Kia, which historically is kind of a, I'll call it a budget car. Mm-hmm. But they've been doing a lot of really interesting things in the electric car space. So there, it's kind of intriguing what's happening there. My feeling is Apple has done so much behind the scenes for a self-driving car that that at some point the likelihood that it would all that technology would find its way into an actual car is pretty reasonable. And where we are right now with everything that Apple has going on, or at least where they appear to be in a development process, they're at the right point to be talking with someone to actually manufacture the car for them, because they can't build a car factory. It, you know, like they didn't build an iPhone factory. They went to someone else for manufacturing. And so they're at the right point to start looking for someone for that. And that means that if this is the case, that we're getting much closer to an Apple car, if it is going to happen, you know, we could see it as soon as 5 years from now, maybe a little bit farther out than that. But well, I'd say the earliest is 5 years from now. And that's because US, or not just US, but car design and production is a very slow process.
Are we talking about an electric car here or a self-driving car?
I think we're talking about both. An electric car that has intelligence that goes beyond what we're seeing in a lot of other cars today. So, like, you can get a Tesla today that has an autonomous driving type function in it. And I think that's the level we're talking about, what Tesla is doing, as opposed to what we can see in other cars. If you go out and buy a brand new Prius, it has all these sensors on it. And if it gets, you can set it to cruise control so that it'll keep the same speed and you're steering. But if it gets too close to the car ahead of it, it'll slow itself down. If a car drifts in too close to it on the side, it'll take control of the steering wheel a little bit and move you out of the way, stuff like that. We'll see something beyond that level. That's my guess.
Yeah, that would make sense because Kia, as a manufacturer, when they came into the market here in the UK, what would be about 10 years ago, I think Kia came in. And they upset the market there greatly by coming in with this 7-year warranty, which they were targeting maybe my kind of age group who were looking for a car that you'd have a set cost, you wouldn't have to worry about for the next few years. And having a 7-year warranty was something new that hadn't been seen before. And that shook up the car market. Everyone was at that time was on maybe 10 or 12,000 miles for the first year and the first year's warranty. So Kia have a habit of coming in and shaking the market up with something, a new approach to it. So coming in with a semi-automatic self-driving car, which does, as you say, most of the things around, certainly on larger roads, dual carriageway motorways, where it's easier for the car to actually drive itself. City driving is still going to be something very difficult for an auto car to do because there's just so many variables that come into it. But I can see the attraction for Apple going with someone like Kia, a small manufacturer. They could, as Apple likes to do, like we have a company here called Marks and Spencers, and if they start dealing with you as a supplier, they very quickly become your main supplier and then take over your production and how you work. So Apple have a, you know, they've had a habit of coming into an industry and doing similar to the industry. So some of the bigger car manufacturers maybe don't want to be tied up with Apple because of that fear. So Kia would sound like a good fit to me.
I like that logic.
My thought process was that, again, was as something you mentioned, Jeff. I think Apple have spent a lot of time now looking at different components and specializing in them. Certainly the battery technology for a car is probably, I'd say, 85 to 90% complete in that regard. The interesting thing that I found as well was I was fortunate enough to go to Apple Park just after it had been completed. And something that I saw, and I know the Californians didn't particularly like it, but Apple introduced autonomous vehicles to pick up their staff in the local area, and they seem to work extremely efficiently, and they've kind of gone off the radar at the moment. There's been no mention of that, of how successful they've been or what's been going on behind the scenes.
You know, the autonomous vehicle thing that Apple was doing, and I don't know if I'm correct on this, but I think I'm correct on this. That was part of their the trial program that autonomous car makers go through, where they get a special license from the state of California to be able to put their vehicles on public roads under specific circumstances, and it's a limited license. So, which means it expires. So it's possible that Apple's license for that has expired. Also, where we are right now with lockdowns because of the pandemic, there's not nearly as much need for that. But wow, I mean, what a great way to do real world testing. You just make these custom vehicles that you use for your own company and do your own testing that way. It must be nice to have that much money.
I was wondering if they were going to be talking with Mercedes, who make the smart car. So the smart car is basically Mercedes rebranded. And I was wondering if Apple was going to go down that route, you know, just a two-people car, which would just be a city car, which would just drive around and not be the motorway. So I'd say, okay, we'll leave that to Tesla and we'll just do city driving. And then you can customize it. So you could then have, just like the smart car, you could take off the different panels and then they could customize the interior. And then you'd be a small little car, a bit like Zipcar or something, where you could just rent it for by the hour and you could just utilize it. And then if you were regularly renting it, you could change the colors of it, or you get a very giant lightning adapter which you'd have to plug into it or something, and each one would be different, and each year you'd have to get the new adapter to plug in. But it has been done, and I would say that if they're going to sell it outside of the United States, and if they want to comply with other countries' regulations, they would probably have to make it adaptive to different types of road sizes, because we've got quite narrow roads here and we don't have the luxury of six-lane highways like you do in some cities in America. So be very interesting to see which route they would go down, and be very interested to see if they go with their old friends Pininfarina, who they used when they were working out what to design the Apple Macs back in the 1980s.
We have, as far as I know, there is a limited trial going on in the Norfolk area for automotive cars there. But the criteria there is yes, the car is in full auto drive mode, but there is a driver behind the wheel who's meant to be a failsafe in case anything goes wrong. He can take control, but they try as much as possible to let the car do the driving, and that's a trial currently, I believe, going on in the Norwich and Norfolk area. So that, again, a step forward. It kind of frightened me to a certain extent, until I would have thought you either have to have a switchover date, that either one day we all drive auto-drive cars or we don't. The thought of having half and half on the road just sort of doesn't give me fill me with entire confidence that, you know, the car hurtling towards you, that is it going to stop in time because it's an auto car, or it's just some lunatic 19-year-old driving like a complete lunatic?
I have a couple of comments on this. First of all, I drove a smart car for probably 8 years and absolutely loved it, because It never broke down. It always got good gas mileage, of course, but it was so well made that it just never broke down. I felt safe in it, even though people would say, how can you feel safe in such a good car? The frame of it was made by Mercedes, and it was as strong as it could be. My other comment is, when you talk about, okay, first of all, I'm 80 years old, and I haven't driven for about 4 years now. I gave up driving. And I think about having an automated car where I actually could go somewhere on my own without paying for Uber. But I also think about people who don't stop driving when they should because they think that the car is going to protect them. And I went through this with my dad, and it's really hard to take the keys away from a Southern man, let me tell you.
that might be my Charlton Heston moment when you'll have to take my car keys out of my dead
Well, that's just about the way Daddy was. And bring up that there could be some problems that probably nobody's thought about people getting in cars and going places when they're not necessarily confident to do it. It may be a small issue in the big scheme of things, but
The other point you need to think about as well is that Apple have always made a great effort about accessibility. And if you look at things like the iPod and the iPhone, they use that. I remember watching the advert where a deaf mother was able to see and have a conversation with her child through sign language over the iPhone using FaceTime. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have something like a fully automated car, then people who are disabled, who have no option, no way of being able to drive a car or get themselves around, could now with the ability with their own auto-driving car, go to the car, get in the car, say, take me to the library, take me to Aunt Jude's, take me to the Buckingham Palace. And so, again, that could open up a whole area market of cars for people who never would have been able to drive in normal situations, blind, deaf, disabled, anything could. All of a sudden, and like you mentioned there, Nancy, age would then stop being an issue about having your own car.
As long as you were happy with your car coming in silver, grey, rose, or gold.
Or white. But don't forget white. You know, the Apple car will be white with a logo.
You know, the fact that you'll have color choices, we're already a step up from when Ford released the Model T, you know, because you could have any color you wanted then, as long as it was black.
That's right. Yep.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I don't know if any of you know the story between the delay of the white iPhone when it was first announced. And it relates back to cars. Apple actually went to a car manufacturer to try and solve the problem of making a white chassis iPhone, and it was the pigment in car paint that actually produced the very first white iPhone. And the interesting thing is the sale of white cars skyrocketed the year after the white iPhone was launched. So that says a lot for Apple's influence on the market. There's far more white cars now.
Good topic, Craig.
Okay. Do we want to move on in terms of news for our last subject?
The new MacBook Pro, and I've read lots on this, and it's almost like they're revisiting the MacBook Pro's greatest hits and dropping things that are less successful. So there's talk of MagSafe coming back. They're talking about more ports, possibly an SD port, touch bar going. And it's interesting because I've got a MacBook Pro, and the MagSafe thing for me is actually, I'm a huge fan. So if it came back, I would be abnormally excited over something quite so minor. But if you can remember those, is it the 1980s adverts? Is it 19 with the two Mac and PC? The one where PC's got a broken leg because he's tripped over the cord. I'm talking that sort of MagSafe. You know?
The one thing I want to see back, and I miss it, and the other day I had a 17-inch MacBook Pro for years. My go-to machine, my absolute perfect machine, did everything for me, was not just the lit Apple logo on the back of it, but the little LED light at the front that used to just pulsate when it was in sleep mode. It would sit there at night, mm-hmm. You'd see it pulsating away, and it was meant to be a normal resting heartbeat. And it would. You'd sit there and you'd watch that and you'd just calm down. So, yes, please bring that back. Please bring the little resting heartbeat LED light back.
How about the little button you push that shows you with little LED lights how much charge is left on your battery?
Yeah, I missed that.
Apple for years used to have on their LinkedIn page just one picture, and it said, "This MagSafe saves 1,000 lives a year in the ER room." And that's all they had on their LinkedIn page for years and years and years. Because when they looked at all the accidents that would come into what we would call the emergency, accidents and emergency, they discovered that the MagSafe saved so many lives because the cable would go spinning across the room, but the expensive, heavy, solid aluminium MacBook would stay place. Now, from an engineering point of view, the MagSafe is a brilliant invention because I can then tell anyone over the telephone, has the charger gone orange or green? Can you connect it up? Do you hear a click when it clicks in place? It's all the things you can talk over telephone, and especially with lockdown where you can't actually go into someone's house, having a physical color change is very successful from my point of view. So I'd love that. And having the SD card would also be brilliant because the amount of times I would just want to take one or two photos off my DSLR and stick it into a Mac is huge, which is why I refuse to move up from my 2015 Mac, because it would lose the MagSafe and the SD card.
I'm taking all of these rumors with a big grain of salt because they started with Ming-Chi Ko. And, you know, and he's a technology analyst, investor analyst. And he does not have the solid track record that everyone seems to think he does. Like, his track record is actually pretty bad. So that said, let's start with MagSafe. I love MagSafe. I hated losing MagSafe when I got my, I think it was the 2016 MacBook Pro that moved to USB-C and Thunderbolt 3. And it just broke my heart to lose MagSafe. That said, we are far enough down the road with Apple making changes and updates to all their products that, for as much as I love MagSafe, I don't want them to bring it back to the MacBook Pro, because what I want them to do is give me a unified connector across all of my devices. I now want to have USB-C on my iPhone, so I can have a single charger and single cable that charges every freaking thing that I own. But I have an idea of what MagSafe could be on the MacBook Pro or whatever Apple laptop you're buying. Instead of being the cable that clicks to the side of your laptop, how about a MagSafe plate that when you're at your desk, you can just set the laptop on this plate and it has an inductive charging system built in there. So you can still charge from USB-C like we do today. But if you want to have a system where it's doing a wireless charging, then you buy this accessory plate, and third parties could make their own versions as well. And you just set your laptop on that when you're at your desk. Now, the touch bar, my feeling on that is what Apple really needs to do instead of take away the touch bar is put it on all of their keyboards, because once it's on all the keyboards, now you have the ability to have this ubiquitous control system that developers can really embrace. Right now, they have to embrace it for a subset of Apple computers, and that just doesn't seem like an important investment for a lot of developers. And I think that what Apple could do with the touch bar on their laptops is take it off the top of the keyboard where it is today. Now move it below the keyboard where the trackpad is, and make it go across the entire length of the laptop. And now you have this multi-touch surface that has palm rejection and all of that, that works as a trackpad when it needs to, can be configurable so it can have all these other interface elements that happen customized based on whatever app you're using. And now you have the touch bar, but it becomes this this really useful tool on the laptop. But still, it needs to go on all of the keyboards. And then on the other ports coming back, I don't see that happening. Apple doesn't look back. They look forward. And as much as people want to see an SD card slot come back to the laptop, the reason it went away, from what I have heard, is because so few people were actually using it that it became something that was there for just a very small niche subset of users. So it goes away. And I just don't see that coming back. And I've seen rumors that Apple's going to bring back USB-A ports. Nope, not going to happen.
Jeff, I think there was always a kind of reticence about dongles. Everyone hated dongles. But I think Apple learned a lesson that people actually accepted having to use that when they first changed over some of the ports. All of a sudden you had to have a dongle for an Ethernet connection and then a HDMI and all that. So we've all got used to having a bag full of dongles or having the odd dongle. So that could be a reason why Apple don't have as many ports on, trying to reduce the number of ports and outlets on any of their kit. So that because people, okay, fine, I'll go and get a dongle if I need that bit of old technology.
Yes, I think that's part of it. Also, I think we have a very short memory span when it comes to things like dongles. And this will date me. I remember having to buy a dongle called an AAUI transceiver to put my Mac on a network. I remember having to get special dongles that went off of ADB for different things. And when Apple moved to USB, well, then I had dongles to use my ADB devices. So anyhow, the whole thing with dongles, we have been dealing with this literally for decades. And it just so happens that every time something changes, And we have to get different dongles. People complain. I can't believe Apple's making us buy dongles now. The thing about dongles today is that with Thunderbolt 3, Thunderbolt 4, USB-C, what Apple's done is they've taken the PCI slot in a desktop computer and turned it into this tiny little connector plug on the outside of the computer. So now you can do anything with your computer, and it makes it much more expandable than it could have been in the past, because you don't have to deal with the performance bottlenecks that you would get from, say, using a USB-A port for something. And so because we have these ports that give us so much versatility, having to use dongles to make that happen kind of makes sense. And I expect at this point that on a regular cycle, I have to replace all my dongles. But here's the thing. Now that we've been going to USB-C, instead of having to carry a set of dongles for my Mac and a set of dongles for my iPad when I travel to conferences, I carry a single set of dongles and the same charger, and I'm set. So it doesn't hurt as much as it used to. And then the thing with extra ports coming, yes, of course it's going to come. Where we are right now, with the current batch of M1 Max, Apple's not going to put more ports on those because they don't have the I/O bus for extra ports, which means that if you want to have full performance, you don't want as many ports, full performance bandwidth for those ports. So if they were to double up the ports, now you're having to share that I/O bandwidth across multiple ports, and your performance will noticeably suffer. So when Apple releases the next upgrade to the M processor line, my guess is we will have more I/O buses in that system, which means now they will add in more ports. So I think more ports are coming. The reason we don't have them today is not an artificial limitation. It's a performance issue, and it's a hit Apple didn't want to take with these computers.
And I have to agree with your analysis of the touch bar. I love the touch bar on my MacBook Pro. It does so much for me. It's contextual to whatever app I'm in. When I'm on the net, for example, being able to quickly just one tap fill out, what's your first name, what's your surname, what's your telephone number, all that kind of stuff. Just being able to tap that on the touch bar is brilliant. and it works really well. I thoroughly enjoy it, but I have got a wireless Mac keyboard, and having to go back to the old buttons drives me mad. I keep, you know, I'm kind of touching them, trying to think they're going to work, and they're not. So yes, if they could put a touch bar onto the wireless keyboard, that would be my next purchase straight away from Apple.
The interesting thing is if you've read the statistics that Apple have released in small quantities, they say that the touch bar does not come across as successful in all countries. So that's where it gets interesting. In the UK, we got a very mixed reaction to it. It's considered, when I went to the Apple store, when we last could go to them, they said it's one of the least used features in the UK. So UK is slightly different than, say, some of the other countries, but they have more problems with people dropping stuff on it. Or not knowing how to use it. So one of the geniuses said, yeah, we have a whole section of how to use your touch bar, because people just didn't know, well, why would I need it? What's it for? So from a slightly English perspective, I thought it was quite interesting how it differs slightly.
You know, that's really interesting, Alistair, as well, because I know we've tied up with a couple of the American mugs recently, and we've been watching some of their really good training programs and assist programs, but I can't ever remember seeing one on how to use the touch bar. I don't know whether that's something we should look into, because as I said, for me, I can't understand why people don't use it. It has so many advantages when I'm in Final Cut Pro, when I'm doing GarageBand, when I'm doing Word, or even Pages. The bits and pieces you can quickly do on it, I find very, very useful.
I have a hypothesis for you. From the U.S. perspective, and I think that there are a lot of people in the United States that buy Mac laptops and use them only as a desktop computer, which to me is just crazy, because why not buy like a Mac Mini or an iMac, where you're going to get a lot more for the same amount of money for something that's just going to sit on your desk. And a lot of these people that are using their Mac laptops as desktop computers use them in closed lid mode. So the touch bar is not only out of the way, it's just completely useless because you can't get to it. And I think because of that, there's not as much interest in learning how to use it, because it's something that people literally don't even see.
All right. Yeah. But if it was on your keyboard, you'd be surprised how much more you'd use it.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
I'm going to throw a spanner in the works, because I have two theories of this. Firstly, in regards to the touch bar, I own a MacBook Pro with a touch bar and I hardly ever use it. The only thing I would ever use it for is some suggested words that come up when I'm typing, or if I'm using tags for colors of folders. They're the only two things that I ever touch it for. So I wouldn't really miss it if it went away. In regards to Jeff's thoughts on MagSafe, please, 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 Apple, bring it back. I miss that so, so much. I also support your theory of maybe like a pad or a bar that you can place your MacBook or MacBook Pro on and it charges conductively. Something that you may want to look at the next time we can and actually get into an Apple store is just have a look at how the devices are charged in store and where their actual power cables go to. If you notice, they actually have a miniature version of the MagSafe on the other end of the charging port that taps and connects to the table. And they've been using that for many, many years now inside the stores. So it's a very similar premise to a miniature scowl of the Apple Watch charger that we currently have, which I reckon that's going to be the future of how we're going to see MagSafe.
Yeah, and now if they do that, which, by the way, that whole setup is very cool. I know exactly what you're talking about. Then it takes away my one ring of chargers, you know, one cable to rule them all. And now I have to have multiple chargers again when I travel. You know, when travel actually is a thing again.
Yeah, I wonder what they're going to do with that. I'm intrigued. There's lots of speculations about, oh, I can lay my watch on my MacBook and it's going to charge. I don't really see that happening. Another major topic, not necessarily all for tech users, but even the BBC picked up on this one, is that WhatsApp has had a flock of users move away from its platform after Facebook sent a notification in regards to how data is going to be shared with its partners and other partner companies. And in that regard, that includes Facebook and Instagram. One thing that wasn't very well communicated on their behalf is that it currently doesn't affect us yet. And there are also different rules based on your location. So UK users have different rules to the US. I don't know if Alistair wanted to give his advice on this particular one.
Currently, the UK doesn't have to adopt the US rules until May because of Brexit rules. So currently, the UK have a stronger data protection law than US does. So currently, WhatsApp can take information from your contacts, your location, your shopping, and various other activities. It has to comply with what we call in the UK the GDPR, and that is a very tightly worded set of rules about what you can and can't do with first party and third party with your information. But because we are no longer part of the EU, Facebook had suggested that they were going to move to the US regulation because they're going to move all their information from the UK and Ireland data centers to America. And thus it would then comply with US regulation. And thus they could go, we would then become effectively US citizens by law, but not by anything else, if I remember it correctly.
The thing that bothers me was, if you go in, you know, if you go to a website, it says, do you accept cookies and do you accept our terms and conditions? And you go in, you follow up, and you can choose which ones you want to do. So functional, yes, but not marketing, not sales. But if you go in and look at who their partners are, the list of partners is phenomenal. There can be several hundred different companies that they're going to share your information with. And that really bothers me, looking at the new privacy rules that Apple are talking about introducing. That does bother me about that so much information that I type in relatively innocently is just disseminated and spread around so much that when you just blindly click, yeah, accept cookies, or yeah, accept the click the yes program, it is quite frightening, the number and institutions that gain all your information.
Then I think this is one of the problems about thinking about the internet being free. So I don't use Facebook as much as I used to. Why? I just feel like it's wall-to-wall adverts. And the irony is, I know lots of people that are switching off using Facebook. They use WhatsApp instead to pass messages and send pictures. As consumers, maybe we need to understand that if you don't pay, you are the product. And actually, if there was a way where, for instance, you had a, whatever you want to call it, I would pay for Facebook without adverts and without tracking. Saying I'd pay loads, but I would actually rather pay directly than indirectly and use the ease of Facebook, the way that you can connect with people easily, but without the adverts and without the tracking.
I think the thing which is, from my mind, slightly alarming is that at least when you go onto a website, it gives you a warning. It says, would you like to accept cookies? Would you like this to be shared with partners? If you sign up for anything or you're buying anything online, it says, would you like to get marketing emails? The problem with this underhanded approach, whereby you have no idea who the partners are and when they're using it, and what level of information for how long they're going to be using it for, is slightly shocking, because you may sign up for something innocently in year one, and then 5 years down the line, the policies have changed, but you haven't been informed, and they're sharing vastly different information than what you signed up for when you first started.
I also think it's unclear with how much tracking is going on with your other internet activity. It's how the web pages also link with each other. So if you look at something on one web page, you know, if you've looked, you know, for instance, at shoes, then wherever you go for the next however many days, weeks, until you look at something else, you keep seeing adverts for shoes. I think that's what's scary, how it influences all of the adverts.
I just didn't like the kind of threat that was there saying, look, if you accept using our site, we're going to send you hundreds of sales campaigns. Or if you tick this box, we'll send the same 100, but there'll be more to what you might want to buy. It just seems to be a ridiculous way to carry on. You know, it's either or. We're going to get you either way you go. But yes, I agree with you, Tony. If there was a way of restricting it, maybe paying for some internet. But the trouble is, of course, it's a bit like the old stable door, isn't it? We've all put all our information on there for years now, blindly, inadvertently. It's there for all time. So if we stop now, is it too late?
Has anyone heard of the Tim Berners-Lee's new initiative about data stores and how he wants to put forwards having a separate data identity? So everyone would then have to sign up to this data identity, which would be set up by the W3C, and they would then control your information. And that would mean that the Americans would then end up with a tougher security because it would be based in the UK. And so that none of the companies could then own the information, and you would then license the information based upon what they told you, and they couldn't change the terms and conditions. I'll put something in the show notes about it, but it's one of the new initiatives he started up.
I think it's an awesome idea, and good luck getting it to happen, because all the companies that it would apply to are all the companies that really, really don't want that.
Yeah, the lobby for that will be quite a sight to see.
The interesting thing that makes me laugh is that if you look at, what's the most secure platform I should be using for chat? Are they encrypted? A majority of the most popular ones that people use promote the fact that they use encryption. Facebook does in terms of WhatsApp. Then you've got Telegram, you've got Signal. However, the problem is yes, it's encrypted when it's being transferred. What about being at the other end? It could easily be something on your device. The one thing that breaks the entire level of encryption is keyloggers. The minute you're typing a message, however much the encryption is, it's still being recorded. And that still doesn't really come into the privacy aspect of it. It's the most secure way is still face-to-face conversation.
I agree. And the thing which I've always found difficult is that I'm tech literate. So I'm an early adopter on a lot of things. And I was on Facebook in 2006 when majority of my friends in the UK weren't on until 2009 because I had US relatives and they let me come in by invite. And the thing I learned very quickly was it's all very well being on these systems, but if the person at the other end has zero interest in security or is not very technical literate and they don't put a PIN code on their phone, it doesn't matter what transmission you have to get it to the person. If the person leaves their phone unlocked and anyone can read it, or they don't believe in security. There's a feature in WhatsApp where you can turn on, it says, tell me if someone's uninstalled or reinstalled WhatsApp by putting in, by the security code changing. I was talking to my cousins who are based in the UK, and they said, why would I want extra security? And you can't answer that at times. It's the simplicity of, if it works, I'm just going to stay with it.
I also think people aren't very clear that they're dealing with a private company that has terms and conditions. A classic example, sorry to bring this up, but Twitter is currently banning people.
No.
Yeah. And there's lots of discussion about how dare they ban someone. Surely this is a matter of free speech. To which you want to reply, no, free speech is being able to say what you want within reason, because you couldn't go into a crowded place and shout fire. But actually, Twitter is a private company, and one of the things you do right at the beginning, which you've probably forgotten about, is you agree to their terms and conditions. And their terms and conditions could be that you agree that you're always going to have purple underwear, or you're never going to wear socks. And people just sign, yeah, you know, or you're going to sacrifice your firstborn, you know, and they turn up and go, right, we've come for them. But when you sign that piece of paper, you're actually saying, well, I agree with your terms and conditions. And at that point, everything else is moot. You know, they can ban you, for instance, at the drop of a hat if they think you have broken their rules. There's been lots of discussion, lots of comments with people going, this is outrageous, and you want to go, no, it's not. He Who Shall Remain Nameless have broken their rules as far as they were concerned, and therefore they can totally ban them.
In the United States, we have raised personal privacy to a level where it's really a fetish. And in some ways, that's actually a good thing, because the more aware we are of our privacy and when it might be compromised, I think that's smart, just to be aware. The problem is that we have this fetish, but at the same time, we don't really have the understanding of what it means to give up that privacy in different ways, like letting Facebook just siphon just incredible amounts of information about us, and then sell it. The thing with WhatsApp, I know so many people in the United States and outside that switched to WhatsApp many years ago because it was a cross-platform, encrypted, just totally private way to communicate and keep your privacy intact. When WhatsApp was bought by Facebook, I knew, even though the company line was, we're not changing your privacy in the app, it was just a matter of time before it happened. And then last year, when the founders of WhatsApp left, I knew that the time of when was getting much closer. And now here we are. So the fact that we're seeing people leave WhatsApp for other private messaging apps does not surprise me. And at the same time, I expect that there are a lot of people that ultimately will start using WhatsApp again because it was easy and that's where everyone was. Just like people staying on Facebook and using Facebook Messenger. Well, that's the only reasonable method of communication they have with certain groups, like their family or some of their friends. So ultimately, Facebook gets away with it because people are so reliant on what they're offering. In the United States, we've heard a lot of people complaining about what's happening with WhatsApp, and pretty soon they will forget and start using it again and move on to the next thing that they want to be upset about, which, who knows what that will be. We live in crazy times.
I'd like to bring up the issue of personal responsibility. Personally, I have a t-shirt that says, "It's true, I don't use Facebook." And I wear this and people giggle at it. But at some point in time, we've gotten so bad in the U.S. about if something goes wrong, it's everybody else's fault and not mine. But the bottom line is I'm responsible for what I put on the internet and what information I give out to other people and where I do it. And when I'm teaching beginners how to use their computers, that's one of the things that I feel morally obligated to include in the training because they don't know. I remember when I taught my dad how to use a Mac when he was about 83, and he just used it for emailing his grandkids, that kind of thing. I remember the first time that he got a porno email from somebody and he flipped out, but he didn't know what to do about it. He didn't know why he got it. He didn't know where it came from. He thought people were going to think that, you know, he was into that stuff. And it was simply a lack of knowledge about how it works. I think until people get to the point where they start taking responsibility for their own behavior and their own actions, we're going to continue to have this, you know, constant, I'm not going to use Facebook because this, or I'm not going to use what's it, whatever you called it. Bottom line is it's up to me, but it's also up to me to make sure other people that I know think that way.
Nancy, this is one of the reasons why you're so awesome.
Hey, Jeff, would you like to just, you know, come over and move in and just tell me 3 or 4 times a day?
Let me go pack my bag.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. But thanks for listening. We had so much fun chatting to our guests that we have created an extended edition of our show. We hope that you have enjoyed part one of our discussion. But next week, we will be diving deep into the discussion on automation on the Mac. Until next time, stay safe.